I feel for that little squirrel from the first reading, darting out from under the wheels of that gigantic, rumbling 18-wheeler, hot wind rushing through his hair, loud noise shaking him from head to tail, his soul quivering. I was interested to learn that poem was written in 1979. I can't imagine how the author might describe that squirrel now, when it seems like the pace of the world has picked up tenfold, maybe more. I look around and I wonder how many of us feel that way sometimes. Tiny, caught in or underneath something huge, dashing around as best we can, staying low to the ground, our souls quivering. We are caught, many of us, not in the wheels of a giant truck, but in the wheels of a world determined to fling us from thing to thing to thing as we try our best just to get our feet under us again. Our lives move at a pace, an intensity that many say is unmatched in any period in history. There are more opportunities, more incentives, more fears about what happens if we don't than ever before. It seems almost inevitable ending up in the fast lane. But must we stay there? I heard a moral tale not long ago that illustrates something of our modern dilemma. A business executive from the East Coast was on vacation, relaxing on a beach in small town California when a fishing boat came ashore. The executive noticed the enormous catch and complimented the captain on the size of the catch and asked, "How long did it take to catch that many fish?" "Not long," was the reply. "Well then," the vacationing executive asked, "why didn't you stay out longer?" "Because," the captain said, "this is enough for me and my family. I'll sell some and we'll eat some. It's enough." The executive was curious. "So what do you do with the rest of your time?" "Well," the captain said, "I sleep late, I fish for a while, I play with my children, take a nap, spend some time with my spouse. Then in the evening, I go visit my friends in town. I have a few drinks, I play guitar, sing some songs, I volunteer in a few organizations. I have a full life." The vacationer was surprised and wanted to help. "I have an MBA from Harvard and I can help you," he said. "You should spend more time on the water fishing. Then you can sell the extra fish, make more money, and buy a bigger boat." "And," the boat captain asked, "after that?" "Well, with the extra money from the bigger boat, you can buy 2 or 3 boats and eventually hire more people to operate a fleet of fishing trawlers. Instead of selling your fish to a distributor, you can start to negotiate directly with the processing plants. And after a while, you'll be able to operate your own processing plant. And then you can leave this little town, it's quaint, but, you know, for New York City, where you can operate the whole enterprise." The captain asked, "How long will that take?" The executive tells him about 20 to 25 years, I would guess. "Okay, and after that?" "Well, my friend," the executive says, "that's where the fun starts. When the business gets really big, you can sell stock in the company and make millions." "Wow, millions. I like the sound of that," the captain says. "What happens after that?" "After that, you'll be able to retire on the coast here, sleep in every day, do some fishing, play with your grandkids, take a nap, spend time with your spouse." Captain shrugged and walked away. Yeah. That story misses some of the nuances of modern life, of course. There are times when we must work hard. periods that demand extra effort, and seasons of life when we must work more. And the margin with which we are working, the extra fish, as it were, that margin does not always feel so large, the fish not so abundant. We don't always feel so free to shrug and walk away. But there's something to that story, nevertheless, particularly when we realize that that helpful Harvard executive, he's everywhere. He's in magazines, he's on the web, he's on morning TV talk shows, he's got a helpful advice column in the newspaper. He is urging us on, always, everywhere, prompting us, how can you maximize your return, make your efforts worthwhile, get the most for your money, make the most of your time. Eventually, he ends up in our heads, nudging, nudging, nudging. You could do more, be more, make more. If we listen only to him, he'll push and he'll push and he'll push till we've got nothing left. How do we emerge from that onslaught? How do we begin to push back, say no, or say a deeper yes to that which matters most to us? I wonder sometimes. Most of us don't like being overbusy, don't like feeling torn from this thing to that thing and the other. So why are we so prone to listening to that Harvard guy in all his forms? Why are we so prone to running so fast? It seems to me there must be more to it than a simple desire to maximize our returns. I can't help but juxtapose Gerald Stern's manic squirrel from our first reading with Wendell Berry's picture of serenity among the trees, the water, the images of sleeping cattle from our second. Those sleeping cattle of his tasks laid to the side, idyllic, peaceful, and quiet. Except that then what I am afraid of comes, he writes. What I am afraid of comes. There's a saying that when we slow down, it gives our soul a chance to catch up with us. Perhaps we don't always like to do it because it gives everything else a chance to catch up with us, too. Wayne Muller, in his book, Sabbath, tells of Juanita, a Native American who leads people on vision quests, journeys into the wilderness where they live for 3 days alone, listening for the teachings that arise when one embarks on a sacred pilgrimage. What people are most afraid of, she says, is not so much the dangers that lurk in the wilderness, the wild animals, the darkness, or the cold. Most are far more anxious about having to confront whatever comes up in the empty space when they are quiet and alone. Who knows what terror lurks in the anonymous silence? What voices will arise in the solitude? And in that same book, a doctor confesses that for him and many of his friends and colleagues in medicine, part of their rush and hurry is a fear of the terrible things they will feel in the quiet. They are so close to so much suffering and loss, they are afraid that if they stop, even for a moment, the sheer enormity of sorrow will suffocate and overwhelm them. And so my question for us: how might our unspoken fears and sadness be speeding up our lives? Muller writes that we keep moving faster and faster so we will not feel how sad we are, how much we have lost in this life, friends and lovers, dreams that have not come true, all that has passed away. And I will add, it's not just feelings about ourselves. There's also our spouse who is ill or struggling or just not feeling right. There's our parents, our planet, our fears and feelings about the children we love. For the first time in history, the majority of American parents don't think their kids will be better off than they are. Each of these alone can generate a whole stream of to-do list items, books to read, appointments to make, conversations to have, experts to consult. When you look at the real, actual, long list of things you could be doing right now for yourself or those around you, combine that with the constant drumbeat equating happiness with doing more and being more. And then you mix in a fear of the feelings that can come up when we actually stop. It's a wonder we're not busier still than we already are. And it's no wonder so many of us shy away from real stillness, from a regular meditation practice, from taking time away and having real, fully disconnected, total time off. And yet, if we don't, how will our souls catch up with us? How will our joy catch up with us? How will the sadness of life's aches ever find us to soften us, to open us, and help us see more clearly? There is a parable of Rabbi Levi, who saw a man running in the street and asked him, "Why do you run?" "I am running after my good fortune," he says. "Silly man," Rabbi Levi responds, "your good fortune has been trying to chase you, but you are running too fast." And our good fortune, contrary to popular opinion, is not necessarily more boats, a New York City apartment, or a California house by the sea. It's not even necessarily found in more success, more fun experiences, or arranging our lives just the way we want them. Our good fortune might begin to emerge when we pause, make time, create space for what's already right here, close, intimate, precious, and slow. Our good fortune might emerge when we take the time to allow old sadness or fear to wash in and through us, clearing us out, as the poet Rumi writes, for some new delight. And clearing us out for life, the kind of life we really want, allowing a deeper call, our fuller joy, to emerge. Last month, our theme was balance. This month, it is emergence. And this is one of those times where one theme flows right into the next. Two of the spiritual exercises on balance were devoted to the power of the pause. There was encouragement to take daily micro rests, from 3 deep breaths to 3 minutes, to center yourself and regain your balance. And there was the macro rest, the Sabbath, the encouragement to take 1 or even 2 full days off a week. Not just off as in not at work, but off as in not working at all. Perhaps not texting or not watching TV, not online, but really taking time away from the countless demands on our attention. There are some compelling models on the connection between pausing and emergence. Jesus spent 40 days in the desert, and from that long pause emerged his whole ministry. The Buddha spent 7 days under the Bodhi tree and emerged enlightened. The prophet Muhammad would regularly retreat to meditate for a month at a time, and it was during one such retreat that he received the revelation from which would emerge the beginnings of the Quran, the Muslim holy book. There is some organic, mystical process that can happen when we step away, when we pause and detach from the crush of the everyday. And while we may not aspire to be a prophet, the Buddha, or Jesus, we too can benefit from this natural, mystical process. Actually doing it, though, actually taking the time, stepping away, making the space, sometimes that's the hardest part. I remember when I was just thinking about the possibility of going into ministry, I went to a preacher I deeply admired and asked her what it took. I thought she would speak to language ability or organizational aptitude or relational skills. But what she told me as the key thing was not innate ability or skill or studying hard. What you need, she said, is to have spiritual practices of steel. Meditation time, family time, you time. You need to be willing to not just do it sometimes, but to commit to it. You need to put that first. And I think she could be speaking to any of us. There will always be more to do, more to solve, more ways to be involved, more ways to help than you can possibly take on. You have to create space in your life for family and friends and yourself, and you have to protect it. You have to put it first. It's the kind of thing a religious community can help support us to do. Sometimes implicitly, sometimes explicitly, we come to worship services together. That's a spiritual practice of creating space. Just knowing other people will be here can help us decide to come. And we, many of us, have joined connection groups, put that in our schedule, carved out the time to create space for ourselves and each other. And we are invited together every month to do the spiritual exercises you receive in the newsletter or see in cards in Smith Hall. Many of you attend the bi-weekly meditation session led here by Joanne Friday, and many of us, I expect, have a spiritual practice. Yoga, time in nature, quiet time alone, something else that grounds you back in yourself that you figured out to do either with friends or alone. And my call to you today, listen to your heart. Do you need more space still? Do you need to recommit to a spiritual practice of pause that you have temporarily put to the side? Even just 3 minutes or 3 breaths in the beginning or the middle of the day? Is there something you need to say no to so you can say yes to something deeper just waiting to emerge in you? That same reporter who wrote about today's parents fearing their kids will not be better off than they were also notes that that's not necessarily cause for alarm. The biggest danger is not failing to achieve the American dream, she says in a talk. The biggest danger is achieving a dream that you don't actually believe in. I go among the trees and I sit still, Wendell Berry writes. All my stirrings become quiet around me like circles on water. And then what I am afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight until what I fear in it leaves it. And the fear of it leaves me until it sings and I hear its song. May we find our pause, move through fear, and allow a new song to emerge in us. May it be so. Amen.